General Organic Biochemistry, a brief survey. In this unit, we will address amino acids and proteins. What does the alpha in alpha amino acids represent? Why don't amino acids form the beta helix? They form an alpha helix, but why not a beta helix? Is it true that both hemoglobin and hair are proteins? What is meant by denaturation of proteins? What is this mad cow disease we've been hearing about? Let's start our study with the structure of amino acids. Now, all amino acids have the same basic structure, and it looks like this. How are they different? They're different right here with this R group. It can be a variety of different groups. It can be alkane-type structures. It can be unsaturated structures. It can be structures having nitrogen in it or oxygen in it. Can have carbonyls, all manner of things. And I want you to note that there are four different groups attached to that carbon right there. And by the way, that carbon that we're looking at is called the alpha carbon. Remember in our numbering of common nomenclature in acids? Sure. What does this tell you? This tells you that all amino acids have a chiral carbon, except for one. Glycine happens to have hydrogen as its R group, so it only has three different groups or atoms attached. So it is not a chiral carbon, but all of the other amino acids, except glycine, all of them have a chiral carbon. That means they all are stereochemicals. Did you know that all naturally occurring alpha amino acids are left-handed? They have the left-handed orientation? Sure. There are virtually no right-handed ones occurring in nature. That is really interesting. It is this left-handed character that permits the formation of the alpha helix, so that when the alpha amino acids hook together, they form an alpha helix because of the left-handed character of the amino acids. If they were right-handed, we suspect they would form a beta helix. Well, let's look at several alpha amino acids. Here's one right here. Now, this particular one is called glycine. It's G, or GLY, and it is the smallest of the amino acids. And remember, it is the only one that has no chiral carbon. Here's another one. Look at the difference in this structure. This is called serine. Ser, S-E-R, is its abbreviation, and S is its symbol. So you will see a three-letter abbreviation for these amino acids, and you will see in many cases a single letter, which will stand then for the symbol for that amino acid. And I want you to note that this particular amino acid contains a hydroxy group. That's right. This is one of the ways in which they can differ. Amino acids may be shown in one of two forms. Now, this form right here is called the molecular form. But there is another form, and let me show you how we get it. If we take the molecular form, and we let the hydrogen from the acid migrate to the amine structure, if you will, like this, it's going to form a charged particle in there. And this is called a zwitterion. The W is pronounced as a V, a zwitterion. This means an internal salt. It's got a positive charge and a negative charge. And you may see it represented sometimes in the molecular form and sometimes as a zwitterion. But you need to check your textbook for a table of amino acids that lists the structure and the names of all of the amino acids. Now, there are several amino acids that are said to be essential. What is meant by the concept of essential amino acids? Well, those are amino acids that humans cannot synthesize from other amino acids, but that they have to have. So those are 9 amino acids, there happen to be 9 of them, that humans must ingest. Give you an example. Tyrosine, by most people, can be synthesized from phenylalanine. And if you look these up in your textbook, you will see phenylalanine and you will see tyrosine. And the conversion is really fairly simple. But if the body cannot perform this synthesis, the result is that metabolic disorder called PKU. And the amount of phenylalanine must be carefully controlled, and tyrosine must be introduced into the diet. 9 essential amino acids, the ones that must be ingested. Now, let's look at the reaction of amino acids in acid solutions and basic solutions. And we will use alanine as our example, but I'm going to show you this time alanine in the zwitterion form. Amino acids and proteins react with acids or bases, and they react like this. Here we see alanine in the presence of an acid. And what happens? That hydrogen ion is attracted to that negative charge, and so it forms this structure right here. So now we have a positive charge. On the other hand, it can react with a base, the hydroxide ion. And when it does, the hydroxide ion is going to pick off one of those hydrogens on the amine group that's producing that positive charge. And when it does, it will produce the negatively charged amino acid and water. Now that's going to be important. It's important because you're seeing a way in which amino acids can react with an acid or a base. Well, imagine then the body ingests a small quantity of a strong acid or a strong base. Well, when it does, amino acids can be one of the systems to help maintain a balanced pH in the physiological system. And because there's so much amino acids protein in the system, then the amino acid proteins make a very, very important physiological buffer. This is going to lead us to look at isoelectric point, which is very often abbreviated to be PI, or, if you will, we sometimes call it isoelectric pH. Now, the isoelectric point, or isoelectric pH, is the pH at which an amino acid or a protein is at its very least soluble point, and it will very often precipitate out. Usually it has equal numbers of positive and negative charges. Now, remember that we mentioned what an excellent bactericide the cresols are? Do you remember why? Yeah, we said that the cresols are somewhat acidic. And because they're somewhat acidic, their pI will cover, the pH of those solutions will cover the pI range of many amino acids and proteins, hence precipitating out those amino acids and proteins. In other words, bacteria that are made of proteins and amino acids will find that when they're put in a solution that contains the cresols, will precipitate out the amino acids and the proteins, or at least precipitate out a significant number of them, so that it kills the bacteria. And that's the way the cresols work as a bactericide. Now we're going to examine the structure of proteins. And to do this, though, we're going to look at the way in which proteins are formed. So let's look at a couple of amino acids. Here are two. These are alanine and serine. I want you to notice that I have written them in a very particular way because we want to remove water right there. We take the hydrogen from the serine and the OH from the alanine. And when we do, the carbon from the alanine is going to bond to the nitrogen of the serine like this. And we produce this structure. Now, this particular structure is a dipeptide, and it is alanyl serine. I want you to notice the link between the amino acid residues. That link right there. This is called a peptide link. But do you see that it is actually an amide? And that amide link then defines a dipeptide. If you have more than one amide link, you may have a polypeptide. Let's reverse the process now by adding an acetic aqueous solution. We take this amino acid, this alanyl serine that we were looking at a moment ago, we treat it with a hydrogen ion in the presence of water. And when we do, we're going to produce those amino acids again that we had started out with. And this process of breaking up a polypeptide or protein by adding acid and water is called hydrolysis. Hydrolysis. Remember that. Breaking up a polypeptide or a protein by adding an acetic solution, acid and water, is called hydrolysis. Let's try combining some amino acids to form peptides. In this first example, we're going to use alanine and cysteine, written in the molecular form. Now, we're going to dehydrate this, so we're going to take the OH from alanine and one of the hydrogens from right here at cysteine. And when we do, that's going to produce water. And we're going to produce water plus. And here is what's left from the amino acids. You have H2N. CH, CH3, CO. Now we go over and we bond to the nitrogen. And we pick up that other hydrogen right here. So it's NH, then CH, CH2, SH, COOH. We're only going to hydrate right here at one place. And that leaves this acid group right here and this amine group right here free to dehydrate with something else and form even a polypeptide. All right, now let's take it and try it in a different form. This time we're looking at the same amino acids, but we're looking at them as zwitter ions. What we're going to do now is look at this and say, oh, this has already lost its hydrogen, so I'm going to take this oxygen and two of these hydrogens, because that's probably where the other hydrogen went, and I'm going to dehydrate there. And it's going to produce H2O plus, and this time it's going to be H3N, and that has a positive charge. Don't forget that charge. CH, CH3, CO, NH, CH, CH2, SH, COO minus, producing a dipeptide that is also a zwitter ion. Now let's try our hand at the hydrolysis process, at breaking up some polypeptides, or at least dipeptides. Let's try to find the hydrolysis products of phenylalanyl serine. Now this is a dipeptide, and what we're going to use to produce this is going to be water and an acid. And when we treat it with water and an acid, the phenylalanine serine is going to split right here at this amide link, that peptide link, and it's going to form phenylalanine, and it's going to form serine. And this is what it's going to look like. It's going to give us H2N CH
CH2, C6, H5, COOH. And that is our phenylalanine. Then it's also going to give us the serine, which is going to be H2N. Remember, we reversed the nitrogen and hydrogen when we were combining it, so we have to reverse it back when we are dividing it up. CH, COOH, and remember that right here we have our CH2OH. Now that's what it looks like when we do it using it in the molecular form. But what if we have the Zwitter ion form? Well, if we have the Zwitter ion form, we'll do it a very similar way, but it's a little different, so let's try it. It's H2O and acid that we're using to create this hydrolysis. We're going to divide it right here at this peptide link, this amide link. And when we do, we're going to produce H3. Let's go ahead and put that plus charge up there so we don't forget about it. NCHCOO minus, and let's not forget our CH2, C6, H5 down here, plus we're going to produce H3N, CH, COO negative, and the CH2OH from here. See how it's done? And it doesn't matter whether you're using it in the molecular form or the Zwitter ion form. It still works the same. Let's look at an interesting amino acid called cysteine. Here it is. Now, notice the structure of this. It has a sulfur in there. It has an SH. When you put two of these together, they will form an important bond called the disulfide link, and this plays a big role in the structure of proteins. So here you have two cysteine molecules. You notice I've written one of them backwards. By the way, give you an example of something about the importance of this. This is responsible for the curl in your hair. Sure. If you take those two hydrogens out and link those two sulfurs together, that will hold your hair either straight or hold it curly. And like I said, we'll see it as an important aspect in the structure of proteins. But let's step aside for just a minute and see it as something very interesting otherwise. Hair permanents utilize the disulfide link. You have straight hair. The disulfide links that exist in your hair naturally are going to hold it straight. So what we have to do is take that straight hair, stretch it around small curlers, which really puts a strain on the existing disulfide links that's holding the hair straight. Then we use a chemical. Now look at that. Do you see that SH in there? That's like a thiol. Can you imagine that it's pretty stinky? Yeah. But anyway, we break the existing disulfide links by using a reducing agent. Then, after we've let it sit for a while, we neutralize it with an oxidizing agent. And we neutralize it with an oxidizing agent, and that neutralizer forms new disulfide links to hold the hair in the curly position. Now, it's not going to last all that long because it's not the natural way for your hair to be, for those of you who have straight hair. But it lasts several months, and it does give the feeling of a nice curly style. Yeah. But we have to talk about what a protein is. Now, a protein is literally a polymer, and it generally contains 50 or more amino acid residues, made from various combinations of those possible 20 amino acids. They are arranged in a linear fashion. Now, these amino acid units are then bonded through peptide links and are cross-linked by disulfide links and hydrogen bonds. I think we need to look at one.
Yeah.
Here's one. This particular structure has 51 amino acid residues. We're using single letter designations to show you the amino acids because, well, that makes it more manageable. And do you see those yellow links? Those sulfur and the yellow lines are sulfide links, and notice they're between cysteines. In every case, they're between two C's. They hold this structure together in its folded or possibly its twisted form. This is the structure of human insulin. There is a very, very similar compound that has been used medicinally, and that is bovine insulin. Bovine insulin has three different amino acids at this point right here. There are four ways to describe the structure of proteins, and you must be familiar with all four ways. The primary structure. The primary structure is nothing more than the sequence of amino acids. Perhaps it's alanine bonded to serine and bonded to phenylalanine and all the way down the line. It's just the sequence of amino acids. The secondary structure is that regular repeating folding, and folding may be a little bit miscommunicating to you. It's the curling, if you will, of the protein chain to form the alpha helix. And not only that, even though it curls, there is a folding or a pleating that goes on that is called the beta sheet, and that is held together by hydrogen bonds. Let's look at it real quick. Here you see the alpha helix. The alpha helix is due to the fact that we're using left-handed amino acids, and therefore they must curl in a certain way. The beta sheet is the folding of this as the structure becomes even more complex. The tertiary structure. The tertiary structure is a folding of the protein chain held in place by disulfide bonds. And let me show you that. Remember human insulin? Well, I have stretched it out, and it looks like some of those bonds are really far apart. But they aren't. They're those sulfide bonds. They're all the same length. So you can imagine then that the protein chain has to be folded over there for that disulfide link to be the proper length. And I've shown you three of them here. And that is where this human insulin molecule folds up. And remember, the yellow S and the yellow lines are those sulfide links holding that folded protein in position. The fourth structure. The fourth structure sometimes doesn't exist. Suppose you have two small proteins and they are associated with one another, and therefore go around as if they are a larger protein. Well, that loose association of two or more small proteins to make up a large protein is called the quaternary structure. Prion proteins are a fascinating subject, and also a subject that can be a little frightening. Let's look at them for a minute. What is a prion protein? A prion protein, suppose we have two proteins that look for all practical purposes exactly alike as far as their primary and possibly their secondary structure go. They look the same. But one of the proteins is folded one way and the other protein is folded the other way. Now the protein that is folded what we call correctly is a normal protein. But the other protein that is folded differently is a prion. So essentially, a prion is a misfolded protein. Therefore, it is denatured. It cannot behave in normal protein activity. What is the danger of these prions? Well, if the prions are in the presence of normal proteins, if you will, they very often induce those normal proteins to change their folding pattern
and misfold. In other words, become prions. And these prion proteins, unlike normal proteins, cannot be broken down by enzymes. Therefore, they cannot undergo natural biological activity. So what they do is they build up. And when they build up, they produce transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, sometimes called, in some cases, mad cow disease. The problem was first detected in humans when KURU, K-U-R-U, a disease in which the brain lost its ability to function, was studied. The members of the African tribes in which some of the people had the disease KURU would, out of respect to their friends and their elders, in other words, out of respect to the deceased, would eat the deceased's brain. And when they did, they ingested these prion proteins. And the infectious prion then does not activate the immune system because the immune system just sees it as a kind of a protein, a misfolded protein, if you will. Hence, the enzyme doesn't perceive it as being sufficiently different in the respects that will tend to excite the immune system. And so the consumption of these prions can induce the formation of prions in otherwise well human beings. It's an interesting topic.
There are several ways of classifying proteins. We're going to look at two ways, simple versus conjugated, and fibrous versus globular, and we'll look at them very briefly. Simple versus conjugated. Now, simple proteins are composed of only amino acids. They are human insulin, for example, is a simple protein. Conjugated proteins, on the other hand, will also contain maybe carbohydrates, maybe metal ions, maybe ribonucleic acid, any one of a number of things. So conjugated proteins are proteins bonded with some other things. Simple proteins are composed strictly of amino acids. Fibrous versus globular. Your fibrous proteins are the long chains of amino acids that can wrap around each other, that forms your hair, your muscles, things of this type. And these fibrous proteins are not soluble in water. They're not even strongly attracted to water in a lot of cases. Globular proteins, on the other hand, are very compact and spherical. And they are arrangements of amino acids that form your enzymes, your hemoglobin and so forth, and they are they're quite soluble in water, are quite attracted to water, forming suspensions. Let's talk about denaturation of proteins. Proteins are fragile, and anything that disturbs their hydrogen bonding or disrupts their acid and base sites or forces the hydrophobic portions, the water-fearing portions, to rotate outward where they're exposed to water, or forces the hydrophilic portions, the water-loving portions, to rotate inward, or anything that disrupts those disulfide links essentially destroys the protein. And when that protein's ability to form or ability to perform as a protein is destroyed, then the protein is said to be denatured. Bacteria is an example. Now, we talked about a way in which we could destroy bacteria. Remember, we put it in Cresol. Well, proteins like bacteria, for example, can be denatured by beating. Well, it doesn't mean you should go around beating something that's infected. But what about beating cream to make whipped cream? Or beating egg whites to make meringue? What you're literally doing is denaturing the protein. Another thing you can do is heat a protein. Sure, heating it will denature it. It causes it to change its biological activity. What about an egg? You heat the egg, you watch that white become very solid. It's no longer able to function in the way in which it was intended. Detergents will denature a protein. Alcohols will denature a protein. So if you have bacteria, you can imagine using some alcohol to cleanse the area in hopes of killing some of the bacteria. Also, acids and bases, because it changes the pH, will denature proteins, as will heavy metal ions. This is why lead metal ions are so dangerous. They denature protein and make people very, very ill. Well, we have briefly covered a lot of things. We've talked about the structure of amino acids. We've talked about amino acids behaving as buffers to help to control the pH level in the body. We've talked a little about the structure of proteins and the types of proteins. And we talked about denaturation of proteins. A better way to teach and learn chemistry.